Good to see you this evening, and I want to encourage you to turn in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 15 tonight and follow along as we look through this section of Scripture. We'll be starting down in verse 21. So try to make it through the end of the chapter tonight. Jesus had left the area called Gennesaret, which was on the northwestern side of the Sea of Galilee, and he was going to the area of Tyre and Sidon. Now, Tyre and Sidon were cities that had existed far back into the Old Testament times. These cities were not Jewish cities. They were cities that were actually the heathen, the Gentiles lived there. And, of course, there were some Jews that had probably moved to that area for business purposes or whatever, but primarily they were Gentile cities. And it's interesting, the King James often, I won't say always, but often uses the term coasts to describe the suburbs, basically, an area around a city or a region of it. And it does so here with Tyre and Sidon. Now, in this case, with Tyre and Sidon, they actually are near the seashore. But sometimes it uses the term coasts, and it may be a town that's nowhere near any water. And so sometimes that can confuse people. Later on, we'll see that in chapter 16 when they're in Caesarea Philippi. It talks about the coasts of Caesarea Philippi. There are no coasts there. There's no water. But Tyre and Sidon actually are cities on the Mediterranean Sea. And they are the furthest north that Jesus ever traveled during His earthly ministry, during His life on this earth. They are the furthest from His birthplace, other than the trip to Egypt when he was just an infant. Other than that trip that Joseph and Mary took him on, this is the furthest from his birthplace that he went. The furthest that he went. And it was actually to Sidon, which was a little further north than Tyre, about 135 miles from there to Bethlehem. And that's about the total range of the distance that he traveled during his lifetime. Like I said, other than that little trip down to Egypt. But that doesn't mean that he didn't travel much. Some estimate, I saw someone had done some, kind of, you know, well, he went here and he would have gone there, and they talked about the different trips that Jewish people make to Jerusalem for different feasts and those kind of things. And we know Jesus went to one when he was 12 years old, according to Luke chapter 2, and from that time on, every year he would have gone to those feasts that they were supposed to go to. And so they calculated from Nazareth to Jerusalem. They had all those calculations. But they figured also, just reading through the Gospels of his ministry, of what's recorded. And obviously John tells us not everything he did was recorded, but of what was recorded, they made some estimates that during the 3 years of his ministry, Jesus walked nearly, or maybe a little more than, 3,000 miles. That's a long way to walk. That doesn't seem that far to drive in 3 years' time, but to walk that far? And certainly in his lifetime, he would have walked certainly a lot more than that. But even at that, he never traveled more than 150 miles from the place of his birth. Like I said, other than that little trip down to Egypt when he was little bitty, and I don't think he was walking yet when he took that little trip. Or may have been riding or being carried. He was a little fellow then. So, his walking in his lifetime, he did a lot of walking, but he never traveled more than 150 miles away from where he started out. How many folks do you know today who've never traveled more than 150 miles? That's nothing. People do that on a weekend trip, and they don't think a thing about it to go 150 miles or more. People travel all over the globe. Some people travel thousands of miles every week for business and things. But Jesus, even though he never traveled to the furthest points of the globe, he still had a greater impact on the world than those people today who do travel all those various different places. It's an amazing thing to think about. Even though he wasn't a great politician, he wasn't a great world traveler that went and taught in places all over the world, he only taught in that one little region there, and yet he has impacted the world some 2,000 years later. There were probably a lot of scholars and philosophers in his day and age, or before or since, who have traveled far more than he did, who maybe were more well known during their lifetimes than he was, but that we don't know today. And yet Jesus is someone that we are familiar with. Even people who don't believe in him, even atheists, they know of Jesus, they just don't believe in him. And so, you know, it's an amazing thing that here was this fellow, lived in a little country off, you know, not, he didn't live in Rome. He lived off in a little country off over there by the Mediterranean, and yet his influence has spread throughout the whole world. And that is an amazing thing for us to think about. In verse 22, we see that while he was there in that area of Tyre and Sidon, a Canaanite woman comes. She came from that area. She lived there. And she came to him and she begged him to have mercy. And she said, "Son of David." She knew who he was. Now his fame had spread somewhat. I mean, it spread pretty good for a time back then. They didn't have television or newspapers even, or radios or things like that. But, and yet, here he was far away from home, and he was known. And she comes to him, and she says, "My daughter is got a devil, a demon. She's possessed. Have mercy on me." Now I want us to think about this. This is one of the few interactions with a Gentile that Jesus has. And so we want to, because since we're Gentiles, we want to learn a little bit about Jesus and his attitude and the things that he does here with this Gentile woman. First, I want us to think about this woman was a Canaanite. The Bible tells us that. Now, if the Israelites, when they came into the promised land, the land of Canaan, had done as they were commanded, and as they conquered the land, had executed all of the inhabitants, as Deuteronomy 20, 16, and 17 taught them and commanded them to do, she would have never been born. She would have never existed, because all of the Canaanites would have been executed. They would have been killed. And so how is Jesus going to respond to this? Now, his disciples, the apostles even, and some of the Jews may very well have wished that she had never been born, and others like her. They thought very low thoughts about those who were not Jews, first of all. But under the Jews, they placed several different categories. There were the Greeks, which they didn't like, but they put up with. There were the Romans that they really hated, but they didn't have any choice because the Romans were in power and in control of their lives. But then there were the other heathen that they didn't know, you know, just, well, they're out there and we don't care about them either. We don't like them, but, you know, they're not here. And then there were those heathen, those Canaanites that were still living there among them, and they really despised them. They really looked down on them. And then, of course, there were the Samaritans, who were worse because they were a kind of a crossbreed between the Jews and the other heathen people. And so they really, that was even worse, they thought. But the Canaanite, this Canaanite woman, would have been near the bottom of the level of what they thought about these individuals. She would have been low down there. They would not have thought highly of her at all. And so let's notice Jesus attitude toward her. The first thing we notice in verse 23 is that he just ignores her. She's here crying, "Son of David, have mercy on me, have mercy on me." And he just pretends he doesn't hear her. Now we might think that that's a little odd reaction for the Son of God to have towards somebody who's in need, somebody whose daughter is possessed by a devil. But we've got to understand something. Jesus knows the hearts and thoughts of mankind, and He knows what's about to happen in this situation, and He knows the lesson that the apostles need to learn. Now I'm going to tell you right now, they didn't learn it right here in this instance, but it was a teaching opportunity for them. And so we might think Jesus is being cold. He's being cruel. He's just ignoring this one. Here's this poor woman, and she's got a little daughter who's suffering. And she's crying to Jesus, and He's just ignoring her. He's just being mean. He's just being cold and calloused. But let's continue to look at this situation a little further. If we were tempted to think Jesus cold and calloused, let's look at the disciples. What do they say? She keeps following Him. She keeps saying, "Please have mercy on me. Have mercy on me." You can imagine the pleading in her voice. If you've ever had a sick child that you cared about around you and you wanted that child to be well, you'd do anything. And you can imagine this mother pleading for her child and coming to Jesus with this. And the disciples, now they know Jesus has healed lots of people. Heal one more. But that's not what they say. They don't say, "Well, Lord, why don't you just, you know, heal her child for her?" You know what they say? "Lord, send her away. Get rid of her." Now there's compassion for you. "Get her out of here. Send her home. Tell her to go away. Leave us alone. She's bothering us." They say, "She's crying after us." And Jesus doesn't do what they want Him to do then. He does turn around and talk to the woman though, and He tells her, "I'm only sent to the lost sheep of Israel." Wow. Now, we know from prophecy that one of the things that was prophesied about Jesus was the fact that He would bring a light unto the Gentiles. And yet He turns to her and says, "Well, I'm just sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Now understand, Jesus knows this woman's heart. He knows her level of faith. He knows what He can say to her that would stop her or that would not stop her. He knows how far He could go. He's doing these things and saying these things for the disciples' sake, because He's echoing some of their thoughts that they're having. Could not Jesus just, not even one Gentile? Couldn't He just heal this, just one Gentile? No big deal. Not asking you to heal every Gentile out there, but just one? The disciples could easily try to have some compassion here, but they say nothing. And then, she's not deterred by this. She still begs Him. In fact, she comes and worships Him. That's a lot more than a lot of the Jews did, isn't it? Now, if you imagine for a moment, and let's play pretend for just a minute and try to put ourselves in this woman's shoes for just a moment. Let's imagine that there is some great physician from a foreign country A lot of doctors nowadays come in here from India. So let's imagine there's a doctor from India. And this doctor is a world-renowned doctor that can cure a certain ailment that we have or that a loved one of ours has. And so we travel all the way to where he is to see him. And when we get there and we ask him, we talk to him, and he says, well, I'm only here to heal and to treat the people of India. In other words, I wouldn't treat an American. That's in essence what Jesus said. Jesus basically said, I'm not here to help the Canaanites like you. What do you suppose we'd do? Would we quit and go home? Well, this woman didn't quit. And I'm not here for you. And yet she didn't quit. Tell you what, this woman's persistence is something. She wants her child to be healed. And she is willing to face ridicule and rejection herself in order to get that accomplished, whatever it takes. Now, the disciples probably are still hoping that he's going to send her away. And after this, they say, oh, I'm only sent to the lost sheep. And then she comes back with, Lord, and she worships him. Would you worship a man that just told you, I'm not here for you? It's almost like a backwards reaction from what we would expect most people to give. But we said, this is an astonishing woman. She is an unusual woman. And she keeps asking him. She asks again, Lord, help me. She knows he can. You know, she's not the, well, you probably couldn't have done it anyway, I'll go find somebody else. She knows he's the one who can help her. And so she stays right there with him, asking him. And then he says something more. Ooh. He says, it's not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. In essence, he just said, you know, I'm here for the Jews, the children of Israel, they're the children, and the rest of you're the dogs. And I'm not going to take what's for the children and throw it to the dogs. Now this was the kind of terminology that the Jewish people of his day and age used to talk about the Canaanites and the Samaritans and others that they didn't approve of. Now see, the apostles, if they're going to take the gospel to the whole world, which includes us Gentiles, because we may not be Canaanites, but we're Gentiles like this woman. If the apostles are ever going to spread the gospel so that we can get it, they're going to have to get over the racism a little bit. They're going to have to get beyond this idea that salvation is only for us Jews. And Jesus is dealing with that very thing right here. And so he said, well, you can't take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. And you can just imagine some of them saying, yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's here for the Jews. It's for us. We're not going to share this with these people. They don't deserve it. Well, none of us deserved it. The Jews didn't deserve it. The disciples didn't deserve it. Now, Jesus told them, he said, you haven't chosen me. I chose you. They don't deserve it. And so he goes on then to say that to her. And boy, she's quick. She comes back with a quick reply. She said, that's true, Lord. She didn't argue with him. No, she didn't argue. Can you imagine? I mean, if somebody came up to you and referred to you as a dog, them's fighting words. That's mean. You don't talk like that to somebody. She didn't argue with him. She said, that's true, Lord. But then she said, yet the dog. Now, she used a different word for dogs here than he did. He used the word for dogs that's just a mangy old mutt out there. She used the word for little puppies. She said, but even the little puppies, they eat the crumbs that fall from the table. And she said, that's all. I just want just a little crumb. That's all. Wonder what the disciples are thinking by this point. They may be even more annoyed now than they were before. Ready for him to just get rid of her. Just send her off. And they would allow this little girl to live her life possessed by a demon. All because she was born to the wrong parents. If she'd have been born to Jewish parents, if this had been a good, respectable Jewish woman that had come up asking him to heal her daughter that was possessed with a demon, the disciples would have been all for that. They're always, he's doing all sorts of miracles here. He's teaching them a little about mercy and about grace and about arrogance. Jesus then answered and said to her, down in verse 28, O woman, great is your faith. And it had to be a great faith to withstand the things that were done and said to her there. She was just, to have the courage to start with, to go in the first place. And then, and knowing he's a Jew and I'm a Canaanite, and I know how the Jews feel about the Canaanites, and yet she thought, I'm going to do it. And then to get there and then ignore her, and she didn't just say, oh, well, he's busy, I guess I'll give up. And then to have him just tell her, I'm not here for you, I'm here for the Jews. And she still didn't give up. And then for him to refer to her and her people as dogs, and then she still didn't give up. This woman had some faith. And Jesus said, great is your faith. And he was trying to help the disciples to understand that faith is not something that you're born with because of your nationality or your race. That's not where faith comes from. This woman had faith, and yet many of the Jews who were born into the religious order of the Jews, they were born into that, and they didn't have faith in him. Faith comes from some unexpected places sometimes. Now earlier I said that the apostles didn't get the lesson just yet. Well, why did I say that? Well, it's not because of anything here in Matthew 15. But do you remember what happened over in Acts chapter 10 when it came time for the first Gentiles to become Christians? You remember what God had to do with Peter? To get him to go and teach Cornelius? He had to send him a vision 3 times telling him to go. Go do this. So it still hadn't sunk in. All those years later, these lessons still hadn't sunk in. You know what? The gospel is for all. And I know that it's frustrating when we see adults who are just entrenched in their sins. They're rooted in sinfulness and rebellion to God. But we have to remember that those poor little children that they're raising were born just as innocent as any other little children that have ever been born in this world. We need to be doing everything we can to try to change. I know we may not be able, those folks that are entrenched in the sin, we may not be able to change them. We may not ever be able to unroot them from the sin and get them planted in righteousness. But maybe we can make an impact on some of the children. Maybe we can make a change. Maybe in the future that change can then come to fruition as those children grow up knowing about the love of God and knowing about the gospel of Jesus Christ, instead of just knowing about the sin and Satan as a father. Maybe they can learn different. Maybe they can be different. After this event, Jesus left. He traveled down, there's a path through the mountains there, down from Sidon to the Sea of Galilee, and he traveled that road most likely, down toward the Sea of Galilee, and he went up on the side of the mountain and sat down there. And as he's sitting there, people began to bring the sick to him. Crowds of people, not just one or two, crowds of people coming with the sick. And you know, it's an interesting thing. A few minutes ago, well, I know it's been more than a few minutes because he's traveled several miles. May have been 2 or 3 days' time traveling from one place to another. But the last place they were, this woman was asking him to heal her daughter, and the disciples were saying, get rid of her. Now he comes over here by the Sea of Galilee, and people come to him, wanting people to be healed. And you know what? The disciples don't ask him to send them away. Maybe they're learning a little bit. Maybe. The indication is that he actually was in an area where there were several Gentiles living at this time. But these people have brought their sick to him. He heals them. The crowd was amazed. And in verse 31, an indication that this was some Gentiles being healed here, verse 31 tells us that not just that they glorified God, but they glorified the God of Israel. Indicating that these probably were heathen people. These were not Jewish people who were being healed. They glorified Israel's God. Not their own false gods, but Israel's God. And Jesus has compassion. Jesus had compassion on the sick, on the weak. He had compassion on this Canaanite woman. He had compassion on this entire crowd of people who, and this is an amazing thing, this crowd had been with him for 3 days. Apparently, he's been there on that mountain healing people for 3 days. And they've been there without any food. I mean, there wasn't just a Taco Bell or a McDonald's down the street or anything. Now, they're out in the wilderness. They're on the side of a mountain. And you know what's interesting is you look at the healings that he does here. And several of them are listed. It talks about the maimed, the dumb, we would call that, we'd say mute today. The lame walked, the blind saw. All these things. You know, those are things that you could tell. You could see if somebody had some disfiguration and it got healed. But you know, these healers today, they always heal somebody of their headache or some internal disease that, well, did they really have that? How do you know? You know, that they ever had that to start with. But you know, if you see a guy come up there and he's only got one leg, and then he walks away with two, you say, hey, you know, that guy just had one leg a minute ago. Now he's got two. You know, that guy right there, he didn't have any eyes. And now he's got eyes and he's seeing. And, you know, you could. These were the things Jesus did were things that could be seen. But here's this crowd, after being healed, many of them, still hanging out with him for 3 days without eating. You ever gone 3 days without eating? We usually complain if we have one of those tests at the doctor, you know, and they say don't eat after midnight, and the test's at 9 in the morning. I say, oh, can't eat from midnight. Can't eat till after I get done at the doctor. It's going to be like lunchtime before I get to eat. 3 days these people had been with Jesus. And they hadn't had anything to eat. And so he didn't want to send them away. He's afraid they'll pass out from the hunger. After 3 days, and they've got to walk all the way back to town. You know, if you ever do go 3 days without eating, you're not going to be going out doing hard labor and that kind of, you know, you'd want to lay down and rest and conserve your energy, right? So he didn't want to send them down the side of a mountain and off to go home, not knowing, of course, even how far some of them may have traveled from their homes. And so he calls the disciples. He said, look, I don't want to send them away hungry. We've got to do something about this. And you know, the disciples, I guess it's easy for us to look back and to look at these things and to just think, why couldn't they get it? You know, it was just a little while ago that Jesus had fed 5,000 people with just 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. Now here they are, they've got a little bit of fish and a little bit of bread, and Jesus says something about needing to feed all these people, and they say, where are we going to get food? Well, in the wilderness. Well, where did you get food the last time you were out in the wilderness with a great big crowd? But you know, I wonder, would we have been any different? It's easy to look back at them and say, well, they should have known Jesus could do something. He wouldn't have suggested it if he wasn't going to do something about it. But really, would we have been any different? Would we have been just like those disciples, not knowing what to say or what to do? So he asks them how much food they have. They've got 7 loaves of bread and a few little fish. Now, by my calculation, 7 is more than 5. And a few is more than 2. See, last time they only had 5 fish, 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish last time. Now they've got 7 loaves of bread and a few fish. So they got more food than they had last time, and last time Jesus took care of it. Why not this time? But they don't even seem to consider that possible. Not one of them said, you know, maybe Jesus, you could do what you did last time when we had this big crowd out here in the wilderness. It's kind of odd. We'll talk about it just a bit more in a minute. So Jesus commanded the crowd to sit down. You know, it's interesting. There's no record of any of them going, oh, but I'll get my skirt dirty, or, you know, what about the bugs? You know, they didn't worry about those things like we do today. Maybe they were just so hungry they didn't care. They just wanted something to eat. Maybe they were about ready to fall down anyway. But, and I kind of doubt they washed their hands before they ate either. You know, Jesus just had that big argument with the Pharisees about washing your hands before you eat. I doubt these people did. They were out in the middle of nowhere. Where were they going to get any water and soap to wash their hands with? Jesus gives thanks for the food as he does every time that there's a meal involved in the Scriptures. And of course, there's more than... He didn't just pray for it. He prayed for it to be multiplied. He multiplied this food just as he had done before. Gives it to the disciples and they pass it out and everybody gets all they want. You know, when we think about the miracles, we've never seen a miracle like that. I know people see things and that they call miracles. You know, they were in a car wreck and they didn't get hurt. No, it was a miracle. But we had never seen a miracle like this. We've never seen anything like that. So it's hard for us probably to even imagine what it would have been like to have been with Jesus during that time. But you might think that seeing miracle after miracle after miracle, that the disciples would become a bit jaded or they'd get used to it, that they'd start to think, well, you know, Jesus can just do anything, so we'll just, you know, go ahead, just do it, Jesus. But in fact, it seems like quite the opposite. It seems like that no matter how many miracles he does, when the time comes, they seem to forget that he can do miracles. I don't know why they're that way. You know, it seems to happen with new things that they become common. Can you remember something in your life that when it was brand new, it was the first time you ever saw it, and it was really exciting, it was really different, and it was just fascinating to you the way it worked or that it worked the first few times, but now You don't give it a second thought. Think about a remote control for a TV. I remember the first remote control we had a wire, so that wasn't really a remote control. That one was kind of easy to figure out. But then when they first came out with one, didn't have a wire. Well, how does that work? I mean, you just push the button over here and it goes over there, and how does it do that? And there are a lot of things like that. The first time somebody brought a TV in at all, and where'd that picture come from? Is there little guys in there doing all that stuff in that little box? All these kinds of things. There are a lot of things. Cell phones and microwaves and appliances of different kinds and features on cars. The automatic turn on and turn off lights that they got on the cars now. And the first time, I forgot to turn the lights off. Oh yeah, they turn off by themselves. I forgot. But after a while, you just get used to that. You just ignore it. It's just commonplace to you. And you might think that that would be the case with the miracles. That after seeing Jesus perform miracles for 3 days, that the apostles would just kind of get used to it. And yet, they seem, quite to the contrary, to be shocked by it every time he manages to pull it off. It's just shocking to them that he can do these things. Well, everybody ate enough and there were 7 baskets left over, similar but different from the 5,000. 4,000 this time. 4,000 men, not counting the women and children, ate from 7 loaves of bread and a few little fish. Another miracle performed. Now, it's interesting, in neither this account or in the accounts of the 5,000 being fed, neither time, none of those times, because really all 4 Gospels record the 5,000, but in none of these accounts does anyone say thank you to Jesus. Ain't that something? They didn't even say thank you. And it's interesting, a while ago when he was performing these healing miracles, they were glorifying the God of Israel. After he fed them from next to nothing, doesn't say anything else about them glorifying God for that. Interesting that they don't seem to be too impressed by that. Well, Jesus sent the multitude away finally. I guess there wasn't anybody left to heal. Wonder if he was teaching while he healed. Wow, that'd keep him busy, wouldn't it? Wonder if they let him rest at night, or if they just kept coming all through the night for 3 days and 3 nights. I don't know. But Jesus finally sent them away, and he took a boat to go to Magdala. Now, Magdala was on the west side of the Sea of Galilee. So he kind of took from the north east side over to the west side. And it's interesting that this particular town, Magdala, we know of Mary Magdalene. She was supposedly from this town. She was the one that Jesus had cast 7 demons out of. But this town was unknown outside of the Scriptures until relatively recently. In fact, Brother Burton Kaufman in his commentary said, we don't know where it is because it doesn't exist anymore. That was written back in the 1900s before he died. Recently, in 2008, some excavations being done over there uncovered the city of Magdala. A Franciscan priest actually was the one who was involved in the uncovering of it. And they found some interesting artifacts there and various things right there on the coast at the Sea of Galilee. And again, people doubt the Bible because, well, that place doesn't exist. Nobody ever heard of that place. And yet then archaeologists find, well, lo and behold, there's that place. I just heard a couple, a week or two back here, they think now that they've found the site of David's palace. They found where David had built his palace. So all these things, the Bible's there. It gives us all these things. We just gotta go find it. It's there. But I wonder, as I think about these 2 miracles in particular, I know there were a lot of the miracles of healing that Jesus did here. But when I think about the feeding of the 4,000 here, I wonder if we ever grow to trust Jesus. The disciples seem to really struggle with that. They never really seemed to get it all through His ministry. They kept having these doubts. In fact, we're going to see that they still hadn't gotten it. Even after all of this, they're still going to have some problems with this teaching about food in a little while. And then I think about this Canaanite woman. And I wonder, are we refusing to take the gospel to certain people? Thinking, judging them beforehand, say, well, they wouldn't listen. They wouldn't accept it. We're not going to take it to them. We're not going to tell them about it because they're not interested. Judging them before we know. That's what the disciples had done with this woman. They had already judged that she was not worthy of Jesus' time and attention. But Jesus decided differently. He decided she was worth His time, and He healed her daughter. We have to beware not to have the attitude that because we are Christians, that we're better than everybody else. We may have had an opportunity to hear the gospel, but some others that we know may not have had that opportunity yet. And we need to help them hear the gospel. Now, if after they've had the opportunity, they reject it, that their blood's on their head. That's their problem. But we need to do everything we can to see to it that they have the opportunity to hear the gospel. Regardless of their socioeconomic background, regardless of their nationality, regardless of their skin color, regardless of any factor, regardless of their past history and a life of crime, for that matter, whatever it may be, we don't know until we share the gospel with them whether the gospel will change their lives or not, whether they'll allow it to change their lives. And we need to keep that in mind. If you need to respond to God's invitation tonight for any reason, please do so as we stand and as we sing.